Welcome to the McGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website, themcguffinman.com, to see what we've been talking about most recently. Our most recent episode was about the NBA Finals, and we talked a little bit about Kevin Durant, which is now hilariously out of date, but 3 weeks ago it was not. Yeah, we also talked about Popstar, Never Stop, Never Stopping, and a variety of other films recently, which I have forgotten. You can also follow us on Twitter, at themcguffinman, and yeah. Rate us on iTunes, tell your friends, all that fun stuff. All right, theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. And now, here are Alex and James.
James.
Yeah.
Here we are.
That's right.
What are we talking about here today?
Today we're talking about Gattaca.
Gattaca, that's right.
Yeah, the 1997 Andrew Niccol debut.
That is correct. Nailed it. We're killing it so far.
Haven't lost a step.
Fact checkers everywhere are pleased.
Sorry. Yeah. No, this is a movie that's I remember liking, and I haven't seen in a long time, and has been on the list, and I was happy to watch again.
Yeah. Yeah. I like this movie.
Yeah. Do you find it dated at all?
I mean, there's a lot of stuff in this movie that if you want to watch it from the right lens, you can make fun of it pretty fucking easily. But it's also kind of like you find this with a lot of science fiction movies where there are a couple things you have to ignore. Like I just saw Memento again a few days ago. And it's always just in the back of my mind that, like, it doesn't make sense that Leonard can remember what the condition he has is, you know? And Gattaca, there's stuff like that. Like, you have to believe that somebody that hasn't seen their brother in, like, 12 to 15 years can't register the fact that they're his brother. Like, you know what I mean? Like, if you thought of your sister now and thought of her, like, 12 years ago and put those two faces next to each other, there's no way you don't recognize her, even if you had lost contact with her, you know?
Yeah.
And just the whole, like, Eugene and Vincent just not looking the same thing, you know? Like, you just kind of have to, like, squint a little bit for some of these things to work. But if the rest of the movie's good enough, I'm fine with it. As far as dating, I think it dated pretty well. Like, there are some things about it that look very 90s, but I mean, Uma Thurman and Ethan Hawke as the leads, I think, is a pretty 90s thing on its own. But no, I think it does pretty well.
Yeah, I agree. I think it holds up very well. I mean, to add to your list of things, number one is the fact that no one can recognize his face when they look at him every day.
Oh my god.
And a picture of him. It's the Superman syndrome of glasses making you a totally new person, I guess.
Yeah, but, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I feel the same way, though. I mean, stuff like that's a lot easier to ignore when everything around it works really well.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, we would have talked about this on Blade Runner, which is simultaneously one of the best movies ever made and one of the shittiest movies ever made, like sometimes within the same scene, you know? And yeah. If the majority of it is good enough, then I'm willing to let a lot slide, yeah.
Like Tears and Rain. what works so well for you in Gattaca that that stuff gets the pass?
I do think it's a really well-made movie. I also think this movie, and this happens sometimes where and I think my appreciation of American Beauty, both at the time it was released and lack of willingness to let it go now, is the fact that it has a really good score. And I think Gattaca has a really, really great score that makes the movie at least 10% better than it actually is. Like, I think that is the type of thing that can absolutely elevate something. And in Gattaca, I think that would be like one of the prime examples for me. Like, I'm certain I like this movie better because the score is so good and used so well, you know?
Yeah, no, I think it's good. I think there's a couple things about this movie, which I think I've made it clear, but I'm about to criticize it, so I'll state it again. It's a movie that overall I do enjoy quite a bit. Mm-hmm. I think some things are a little too sweet and simplified and a little too power of the human spirit over everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the music is a little too a little too sentimental by a little bit sometimes.
Okay.
Overall, I think the score is very good, and I think it does make the movie better as a whole. There are times where I think it's a little too much, but I'd agree overall with that assessment.
Yeah, I think the times that I'm thinking of where it's particularly necessary to me liking the sequence that it's in are like the opening title credits. Like, I think it fits so well there, and the very end. I think it's, I don't know, it just sounds very sad to me. I don't feel like it necessarily sounds triumphant, which I like about it.
Yeah, no, that's not what I mean when I say when I compare it to kind of the themes of the, you know, indomitable human spirit. I think, though, that's a theme that is good and can be used very well, and I think that's a little too much in this movie, and I think that the sentimentality in the sadness of it, I agree, not the triumphant nature of
okay,
it. The music
enough.
Is a little too much by maybe your 10% assessment is correct as well.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, no, and I think the intro is really good, and I remember...
Oh, the opening credits for this movie is amazing. It's wonderful.
Yeah, I remembered the things about him having to clean up all the traces of his DNA. Mm-hmm. I remember that from seeing this movie many, many years ago, and even just watching that sequence again at the beginning and watching all that happen, even knowing all of it, it really still kind of gives you chills, because I think it's the sequence is just put together so well. That idea is very cool, and I think is shown in a very interesting fashion in this movie, mm-hmm. and it's so central to the plot, and I do like movies with, or at least the parts of movies where people have to be so meticulous for such an incredible amount of time.
Oh, yeah.
That's something I enjoy. Mm-hmm. And yeah, just the opening of this movie, I agree, is very, very, very well put together.
Yeah. And I mean, it's so good. Like, and the use of the sound in that sequence is really good. Like when his nail clippings are hitting the ground, there's like this thunderous sort of noise. And it's just that, as well as the cinematography that makes these tiny things look gigantic. It is perfectly in line with the theme of the movie, where these are the things that matter the most. It's nail clippings and it's hair and it's skin, but it, like, these are the things that matter the most, and these are the things he has to take so much care to not bring into Gattaca with him. And I think the opening sequence, before you even know these things, like once you get into the part of the movie where you start to figure that out, I think the opening sequence is just, I think it totally... I don't know, it adds so much to the movie, because it's such a good introduction to what is really going to matter in this movie, and showing it in an interesting way, using, you know, filmmaking, like making tiny things look gigantic, you know?
Yeah, and the sound design, like you said, making the sound of a nail clipping hitting the ground be such an important thing just by the volume of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's a very good-looking movie, too, altogether, right?
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, and it's got the... Something we've talked about a bit recently, but a difficult time period to pin down. I mean, they say in the not too distant future, a very intentionally vague description. But we get a lot of kind of 50s, 60s noir feel throughout the whole thing. And, you know, from everything from art direction to costume design to hair and makeup.
Yeah, and also like a little bit of sort of an Art Deco vibe at times as well, like not too strongly, but there's just something, yeah, there is a timelessness about it, even beyond the not too distant future time card, you know. And I always like it when science fiction movies do that, because it does sort of speak to the cyclical nature of style in general, you know. And like those giant Limp Bizkit jeans will be cool again one day, you know. And I always think it's a smart idea when science fiction movies do that, because then you can both make a movie in 1998 that doesn't look terrible in 1996 for being so wrong about the future. And you're going to get things wrong. Like the computers obviously look like they were made in the 90s.
That was so impossible to do.
Exactly. That's just it. But like, if everything you try in designing the future is an impossible task like that, then it's, you're bound to fail entirely. Whereas, if you sort of trust the history of human trends and whatnot, it's just a smarter idea for the long-term life of your movie.
Yeah, but I mean, we get a lot of things that line up really well with noir here. I mean,
yes, you're right.
we have our detectives that look like they are in a 1950s movie, you know, with the hat and the coats like that.
Yeah.
And some of the 50s and 60s architecture and automobiles, or ones that are meant to clearly evoke those kinds of things. I'm speaking more about the automobiles, obviously. A lot of those buildings that they show were designed in the 50s and 60s, mm-hmm. so that accounts for that. But even just, you know, thematically and plot-wise, we have cases of mistaken identities and an early murder that kind of sets everything in motion, the detectives, things like that. And, I mean, that's something that I'm always going to like, but I think it's not leaned on too hard here. I mean, this isn't, if I went down a list of descriptions of this movie, neo-noir or noir wouldn't be, you know, in my top three, but yeah. It's there, and it's there, you know, in the nightclub they go to, and there's this old kind of gangsterism and detective element here that is kind of weaved in throughout, but is never too hard that it kind of makes the science fiction thing, kind of stand not line up well enough.
Yeah, exactly. It's really just it is there to sort of push. Push certain things forward and to give Ethan Hawke something to be afraid of in his last week before going up. And I'd seen this movie probably two or three times before watching it again for this, and totally forgot about the murder plot, even though it's like it's a thing that drives the entire movie. But I just totally forgot it. Totally forgot Alan Arkin was in this movie, which and normally I have such a good memory for these types of things that it was just really funny to me that I had forgotten such a large portion of the movie.
Well, it's large and it's not large. I think the movie, I think overall, is structured really well. I mean, we get this this idea of the deadline very early on. Mm-hmm. We have this small window that these flights can take off. This next one's taking off in 7 days. And just a little bit after that, we get this this murder. And I think the reason we forget about it, and I certainly forgot about it as well, is that our main character is not responsible for it. It's going to be the thing that is one of the biggest threats to him. I mean, there's the constant threat of where he works being so meticulous about not letting in these invalids. So they're, you know, the constant tough security there, but then that gets kicked up even a few more degrees once this murder takes place. And, you know, we just have this looming deadline and intensifying, scrutiny for this character that already lives his life in such a meticulous fashion for the scrutiny he's constantly under. And I think just for the structure, I really enjoy how that, you know, forces a deadline and gets all our characters really motivated and, They want to figure it out before this deadline. Everyone kind of has the motivation with this deadline. And then we also have Ethan Hawke, and I'm just not going to say their name. Like, I usually try to avoid just using character names, but this movie's particularly tricky for that. So yeah. I'm just going to say Ethan Hawke.
Yeah, no, that's totally fine. It makes it way easier. I went through my notes earlier today. And so I had written down Jerome for one of them. I'm like, which Jerome? Who am I talking? Is this Jude or is this Ethan?
But yeah, exactly. So I'm just going to go ahead and avoid that entirely. Yeah. But yeah, so, you know, there's this constant scrutiny of working at Gattaca. There's this tripled scrutiny of a murder investigation going on at Gattaca. And then we have him, particularly near the end, falling in love with Irene and kind of exposing a bit more who he is, which is just done through the nature of relationships, let alone relationships in a future where if someone kisses you, you can go and get their saliva tested and decide whether or not you want to, you know, continue a relationship with them based on their genetic sequence. So just from a structural standpoint, I really like the way this movie escalates. All movies escalate, but I think this one was done in a really, really natural and successful way.
Yeah, I would agree. I also really love that scene where, with the saliva booth checking, you know, whatever you want to call that business, because that felt like the modern equivalent to that is Googling somebody before you go on a date with them, and I thought that was a really, I mean, it's something that the filmmakers couldn't have anticipated at the time, but I think it's still. That's the first thing I thought of as she's like handing in that strand of hair. And I thought that was really interesting that there is a modern equivalent to that now. And I think it hits so well. Like, you're not finding out before you go on a date with me that I'm going to die at 58 because of heart failure or something. But like, you're finding out stuff about me before yeah. anything really happens, you know?
Oh, you don't think the makers of this film are compu-serving their potential romantic partner?
No comment, I think is what I'll go with that.
No, I agree. And the one thing I really like about that, and this also happens when he's discussing Genoism right at the beginning and says, you're not allowed to hire and fire someone off, you know, their genetic makeup, but drug tests are still legal, and then they'll just make you do a drug test, and then they'll just check that at the time and not hire you, and they never have to explain why. Mm-hmm. And it's just one of those things that kind of shows that the world is a little bit lived in. You know, it's not the way that it would work on paper, but with any amount of time, people would start finding out these things. People would start finding out, oh, I can't test them for this, I'll just test them for this, and then kind of backdoor the information that I'm actually looking for.
Yeah.
And just as you're saying with that, you know, genetic sequencing service, you see kind of the first woman kind of seems to be attempting to find a good genetic partner. And then Uma Thurman, or Irene, comes up and, you know, she's this good looking woman who's got this sequence from or this genetic material from a male. And without anything really being said about it, the employee says, oh, you know, you've got a great catch there. It's a 93. And that's one of those things that a woman working in that service for long enough would see so many of these things that's what comes to her head immediately, even though it's nothing said about it. And that's the thing that I like so much about good sci-fi movies, is when the world's a little bit lived in. Mm-hmm. And there's that shortcut. And, you know, I love the use of slang in sci-fi is kind of another one of my favorite things. And that's the same kind of thing, just these verbal shortcuts that people who, if you did live in that world for any amount of time, would just become second nature to you. And that's such a small example of it. But it's stuff like that really holds movies like this together when you try for a futuristic thing and it's not so clunky and spelt out every time.
Yeah, I agree. And I like going further on the lived-in quality of the film, like when you set these rules out for society, there are always going to be humans that figure out a way to operate kind of deviantly within those rules, you know, and that's the
Tony Shalhoub.
Yeah, exactly. And the you know, we can still test you. That can't be the only reason whether or not you got the job. But we can test you, so it can be the only reason of whether or not you do or don't get the job, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, I really like that element of the movie. You know, it does feel like something where the writer, who's also Andrew Niccol, wrote out what he wanted the society to be, and then sort of started to figure out how people would actually operate within it. And it's exactly what you're saying as far as it being lived in and feeling lived in. And I think that adds so much, you know, as opposed to these just these dum-dums walking around, everybody's following the rules to a T for no real reason, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's one thing I was going to ask you is how dystopian you kind of look at the society as. I mean, because we have this clear, you know, well, by the end of the movie, we can see that the stance of the film is pretty clearly that this would be a negative change. Like, this is moving in a bad direction, right? Mm-hmm. It's just we don't see an incredible amount of suffering going on. We have the very obvious example that's an exception to that is what these invalids have to live like. And there's this huge class divide. Because of the difference of their genetic makeup, right? We get these things that they say, like, there's no blood has no nationality, and ethnicity and religion don't mean as much anymore. But there's this huge divide in society between the valids and the invalids. And so they work menial jobs and clearly would have some problems in, you know, the romantic life and maybe even reproducing. I'm not sure what the laws are about that in the mm-hmm. society. But Ed, I was just wondering about how negative you kind of look at this depiction of the future as.
I don't know. It just feels so odd to me because, just because it's so foreign, right? Like, it feels very uncomfortable, you know?
Yeah.
But like the thing that the movie does a good job of showing is that there will still be people that, even with that being in the 99% of or being as close to perfection as possible, like Jude Law's character is, there will still be things that are left up to chance regardless of how they're engineered before they're born, right? Like the fact that there are other people at the same level as Jerome, if you get to a high enough level of competition, and Jerome losing, like he was never meant to come in second, and him coming in second in anything after so long believing that he was basically perfect, you know, that drove him to depression where he tried to kill himself and eventually does kill himself. And I think that, you know, there are unforeseen like depressions that can come from this type of thing. Like something about it just feels like false promise. Like it sounds great, but there are still all of these little nooks and crannies in between the hard rules of the society and the hard rules of these genetically engineered perfect children, you know? And so it doesn't necessarily feel dystopian, but I don't feel like it's a good thing, you know?
Oh, no, absolutely not. Yeah. And as I said, the stance of the movie clearly isn't that it is a good thing. It's just about how bad the world looks.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, the thing is, it's like the world in Gattaca is shitty in a lot of the same ways that the world today is shitty. You know, there is still a class structure, and certain people, in order to break through glass ceiling, have to be exceptional, you know, depending on their background. In order to even like keep up with the average, they have to be exceptional. And yeah, that exists in Gattaca and it exists in real life. So I think that that type of thing is basically pretty much unavoidable. And I think that the movie makes a smart choice not trying to avoid it. And I mean, the movie is kind of specifically about that quote unquote glass ceiling, you know?
Right. Yeah. And, you know, we're talking about how it's just this class divide at this point that seems to be the big problem. I did really enjoy the touch when Marie and Antonio, the parents at the beginning of the movie, mm-hmm. are consulting that genetic counselor, scientist, whatever, mm-hmm. and they specify blue eyes, brown hair, and fair skin.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, you know, got dark eyes, a head shaved, and yeah. not fair skin. And it's just this idea that when designing anything, you're saying no to so many things, right? And
yeah.
when we come up to like an issue of race or ethnicity and things like that, you know, they're talking to a guy who seems to have a pretty good life, who's clearly very intelligent, and they're just describing the opposite of him as their ideal child. And it's it's a little nod to the obvious racist elements that come up when we talk about designing a child.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think this is as good a time as any to point out one of the other shitty things that you can laugh at pretty easily in this movie is Blair Underwood's voice is maybe one of my least favorite things about this movie. It's so insane, the doctor voice he puts on.
Yeah.
But anyway. But yeah, I agree with and enjoy your point. And I'm sure that I don't remember the doctor's name, but Blair Underwood's parents probably had some version of the same thing when they were deciding what Blair Underwood would be as an adult, you know?
Yeah. Do you want to talk about Ethan Hawke? We really haven't done that much, considering your love for him.
I'm always waiting for an opportunity to talk about Ethan Hawke. Doesn't matter what the subject is.
You don't have to wait anymore.
I love Ethan Hawke. This movie, he's good in this movie, but this movie is not dependent on him. You know, like he's at his best in Richard Linklater movies, where he's able to sort of not be that different from himself. Like he's absolutely amazing in Before Sunset, right? But he's playing himself in Before Sunset, and he's great at playing himself. He's great in Boyhood because of that. He's great in Before Sunrise because of that. But yeah, like it's not like this movie you couldn't switch out the leads and it becomes, you know, it's not as good of a movie, you know.
Yeah,
Ethan Hawke's fine.
Yeah, I really like how he plays his younger self, like the Before the Switch.
Mm-hmm.
He's just got his mouth open a little bit more. He's a bit more just slack-jawed and goofy, and it's not a huge change, but it's a big enough change that, you know, you can tell it was conscious and everything. And you get so little of it, and it's not these big moments where he used to be this totally wild guy, and then he's got a really buttoned down to play the new version of himself. But I thought it was just kind of goofy and fun enough to juxtapose it against the new self that he has to become.
Yeah, like when he's a janitor at Gattaca, you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I really like the way that the teenage version of Ethan Hawke played his Ethan Hawke role as well. I always love it when young actors have to impersonate actors whose career they would love to have. And I think he does a really good job of capturing the Ethan Hawke essence, you know? Yeah. Another like shining example of that is whoever plays young Bruce Willis in Unbreakable is just so perfect. Like it's hilarious. I recommend you go back and check it out. But yeah, I always find that pretty interesting, and it's impressive to me when somebody can nail it that well. And I think the person playing young teenage Ethan Hawke really does.
And I thought the one playing super young Ethan Hawke, they found a very good lookalike. I mean,
you mean Dennis the Menace?
Is that Dennis the Menace?
That's Dennis the Menace / Dirk Calloway in Rushmore.
Oh, good for him.
Yeah. He had a good 90s. The 2000s weren't too kind to him.
I was reading Roger Ebert's review of this, and he enjoyed it quite a bit. But he said of Hawke is a good choice for the lead, combining the restless dreams of a godchild with the plausible exterior of a lab baby. And I thought that was pretty good.
Of a what baby? Sorry?
Lab baby.
Oh, like, yes.
You know, he's got the looks of a, you know, he can be that, you know, very good looking, perfectly designed person, but there is kind of that little bit of that wildness and kind of something more beneath the surface going to him, which I think would be a hard line to walk. And that's why I kind of like him doing both of them in this.
Yeah, for sure. We haven't talked about Jude Law yet, who I think is really good in this movie. I'm curious to know your stance on it.
We have to talk about him immediately.
Yeah. I quote that line from time to time, and literally nobody has ever caught on that it's a reference to a movie. But the "we have to get drunk immediately" line is spectacular.
Yeah, it's a funny line, but it's delivered very well too. Yeah.
Well, I mean, Jude Law has that sort of that Colin Farrell thing where he's a really great character actor that is so goddamn good looking that he has to be the lead, you know, and this is just, we're right in that sweet spot before Hollywood gets him to that lead point, you know? Yeah. And I think he's really great in this movie. And I generally think he's really good in movies that he is not the lead of. And, to quote Sean Penn, he is one of our finest actors. And, and I like seeing Jude Law in a place where he gets to excel, 'cause it doesn't happen all that often.
Yeah, no, I think he's, never upset to see him in a cast, but I think he's very good in this. And it's a weird role, and they have a weird relationship. And I think it's tough, but he's funny and just straight up very dramatically good in this movie. So
exactly, like he is kind of the comic relief of the movie, but he also has very important dramatic moments, you know. And I just think it's such a hard line to walk, and he does it quite well.
Yeah,
even though his character can't walk anyway.
Nice.
Yeah, swish.
We talked about it a bit, but what do you make of his suicide?
I mean, he doesn't have anything to live for anymore. I think that's kind of it. Like, what would he have done if he stayed alive? Like, it's obviously sad. I'm just like, it's unfortunate that this person feels the need to kill himself instead of continuing on living. But like, could he go and be a part of society in any capacity?
I just don't know how wide-reaching this level of genetic advancement is. Like, when he says, "I'm going to travel," I just assume that maybe there are continents of the world that aren't as strict about this kind of thing or can't afford it. So I thought he was just going to go live there. But if these societies are, you know, not as advanced, maybe not having the ability to walk would make living there difficult too. But
yeah,
it's not touched on too much. It's just, I guess it's, yeah. I mean, part of it I think is definitely what you said before. It's in a world where everybody is just designed to be the best, and he can't be the best. You know, the best swimmer. He just doesn't know how to deal with that, and he, you know, through this process of learning to be him, Ethan Hawke learning to be him, they kind of meld together. You know, they spend all this time together. They're kind of, you know, mixing their genetics in a certain sense, you know, becoming each other. And I think he feels kind of part of who he is, so that when, you know, the Ethan version is able to succeed and you leave this planet and go somewhere that, as they say, the ability to walk doesn't really mean anything up there in space. you know, they've kind of combined and transcended. And it's just tough to see kind of a suicide be the happier ending. You know what I mean? It's really tricky, obviously. I just didn't know what you thought about it. But, you know, they seem to have combined and name, and he's got a bit of his hair with him, which is something extremely important in this movie. You know, it's the thing that set so much in motion and had so much to do with them becoming the same person, that there's a lot of significance to it.
Yeah, for sure. And it's not like Jude Law dies thinking he accomplished nothing, like thinking that Ethan Hawke took something from him, because in their last scene together, I think it is, Jude Law says to him, like, I got the better end of the deal. He specifically says, like, I lent you my body, but you lent me your dream. And it sort of gave him something to live for, even though it is something that revolves around him kind of remaining captive, you know, like, it doesn't seem like he gets out very frequently. And when we meet him in the Tony Shalhoub scenes, you know, he's just an alcoholic. It seems like he's really just biding his time until he can try and kill himself again.
He's just cold and bitter.
Yeah, exactly. He's an alcoholic. Yeah. And it does seem like Ethan Hawke's dream gives him something to live for, if only for a few more years, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's obviously significant that the place that he ends up meeting his demise is, you know, where Ethan has been going to scrub all this genetic material and get rid of, you know, bit by bit, try to get rid of or hide his old self, you know, all this biomaterial that is not good enough to function in the society. And that's where Jude Law ends up.
Yeah, exactly. I think that is a nice touch.
Yeah. So we're talking about Jude and his swimming career not being able to be number one. What do you take of the prominence of swimming in this movie? Because we have his career as a swimmer, and we obviously have Vincent Nanton's, you know, Games of Chicken being shown several times and ultimately being very important to the movie.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we're all swimming in the same gene pool, man.
Okay.
No, I don't know. I think
any answer that ends with "man" probably just eliminated.
Yeah, if it's being delivered by somebody that was clearly just thinking about the Big Lebowski or something, you know, then it's really on point. But I don't know. I think it's just like the gene pool idea is kind of a nice, very little sort of tie-in, just in that it is something where it's something that's not quite the same as the earth you walk on all the time. Like, you know, obviously water exists in our day-to-day life, but we're not always swimming in it, you know? Yeah. And the fact that it does tie into a gene pool, and it gives a lot of one-on-one competition opportunities, which this movie needs, and presumably Eugene was racing more than one other person, but it was still a competition, you know? And it's simultaneously something slightly different from the ground we walk on every day that can also be a competition. And just the fact that it ties into the idea of the gene pool is helpful. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, you get the weightlessness of space as well.
Yes, that is true.
And I was thinking that it's different than walking. You know, this movie is so much about will and determination and, you know, pushing yourself to become better and to become the best. You know, if you're racing someone, if you're having a foot race with someone and you stop, you stop and you're on the track. Whereas, you know, if you're playing these games of chicken or swimming for at any distance, if you stop, you die. And I think that's, you know, what we see in this movie is if you can't be number one, or if you give up, or if you don't have the ability to just keep pushing and pushing and pushing, you die. There's just no place for you in the society anymore, whether that's from determination or whether that's from you know, your genetic makeup not being strong enough, you know, to put it kind of rudely, that there's just, you're not around anymore. That's just the end of you, and you literally die.
Yeah, exactly. And it is sort of like space. It is more of an unknown than the ground, you know. Obviously, the waters of Earth are less unknown than space, but it is certainly more unknown than the ground you spend most of your time attached to.
Absolutely. What else do you know of Mike Nichols' career? Andrew Nichols' career.
I haven't seen Sim 1. Actually, I've probably seen half of his movies. I've seen Lord of War, which has a really great opening title sequence, for the record. I've seen Lord of War, and I've seen In Time, which, for those of you that aren't James, I fucking hate that movie.
Okay, I hadn't seen much. I was wondering how similar some of his work is, and I can tell, you know, by what I know of the plots that there'd be some overlap thematically, but I didn't know.
Yeah, well, I mean, In Time is a, like, Gattaca and In Time would be a good doubleheader in that you get to see one movie about a really good idea that's executed well, and then another movie about a really good idea that's totally squandered.
A hilarious singer in each.
Who's the hilarious singer in Gattaca?
Maya Rudolph.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
The film debut.
Yeah, fair enough. But yeah, like, he's a... I don't know. He always tries to get something in his movies that is more than the movie. Something like with actual meaning that's above the plot, which I appreciate, even if it doesn't always succeed. Like, I liked Lord of War, but wasn't crazy about it. I didn't see The Host, which is the young adult movie that he made, the Stephanie Meyer adaptation. That might be the only one that doesn't have something more going on. But, you know, I don't know. It's cool that he's able to still work, you know, like, even though he's not somebody that's like a vaunted auteur in my eyes, like PTA or something like that. Like, it's good that talented people are at least able to keep directing, you know?
Yeah. Cause I didn't realize how little money this movie made.
Yeah. Yeah. He doesn't have a lot of, I think In Time might be the only financial success he has.
Thanks.
Yeah.
And did you read about some of the advertisements for this movie?
No.
Oh, they would just, they didn't really even look like advertisements for a movie. They looked like ads for genetically enhancing your children. And then near the bottom, it would just say Gattaca, then the release date and things like that. But it was just this, you know, because it's a moral question. You know what I mean? I don't think that this one is as cut and dried as some other ethical issues. You mm-hmm. know, I think that as society progresses, I think we get on the right side of history with some issues that seem pretty clear. Mm-hmm. But I legitimately think that this is still a tricky one. And I think that's, you know, that's talked about in this movie when they say, well, can we leave some stuff to chance? And, you know, I forget the exact phrasing, but, you know, he's saying you're just leaving the chance open for alcoholism yeah. and myopia and all these things that you would think, if you were designing someone, you would not want to do for good reason. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing about this movie that I think, So I think that's a real kind of question. I think that those advertisements kind of got people very interested in kind of looking at this, because some people were initially very drawn to the fact that, oh, I can do these things. That's something that I should do. You know, I think there'd be a sense that you'd be a bad parent if you didn't want to fix, you know, these potential, you know, let's say medical or intellectual, you know, landmines that might come up eventually.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, if this type of thing was introduced tomorrow, I mean, it wouldn't be immediately everybody looking to have a child would look into it, because people would want to see examples. But once it's sort of proven to have a pretty decent, your baby is going to come out a baby and not an alien, you know, once enough people saw successes, I think it would very quickly catch on as the dominant form of having a child. You know?
Yeah. And I guess one of the things that I was saying about this movie kind of being a little too clear about it is NASA currently doesn't let people with heart problems take positions like the one he wants.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They don't receive a lot of criticism for it. And I think rightly so. And I think if you're down to one survivor on a ship that could potentially crash into Earth and kill hundreds of people, if NASA did let that happen and people found out about it, I think they'd rightfully be upset. So, yeah, something's in this movie, I think, are a little cut and dry. And that's one of my minor problems with it.
Yeah.
But as I said, overall, it's a movie I enjoy watching and will probably watch again.
Yeah, for sure. That NASA heart disease thing is obviously totally understandable. And another one of those on the list of things of that I'm totally willing to ignore and able to allow the rest of this movie to exist, because I do think this movie has some really, really good stuff about the idea of overcoming who you're told you're going to be. I always find movies about people that are able to succeed just because they're willing to work harder than everybody else. I really enjoy that. Like somebody that is maybe like at their natural level of average or lesser intelligence, but by the mere virtue of the fact that they are willing to work harder than anybody else is able to succeed and be better than what people have expected of them. And I also like the way this movie looks at people that have been told their whole life that they are exceptional and how they have to deal with not being the most exceptional.
Yeah, the flip side of that is interesting. And you don't see that as much at all.
Exactly. And like, and you get that with Eugene and you get that with Anton, who we haven't talked about at all, but I think it's really interesting because he's trying so hard, to find his brother. Cause he just wants to be able to look him in the face and like, see how did you beat me? You know, how am I not able to catch you? You know, I'm better than you. I've been told my whole life that I'm better than you. Our parents made me specifically to be better than you so yeah. that I could get dad's name, you know? And I don't know, I think that's just this really interesting thing that I look at as the core of the movie, regardless of the fact that the fact that he is able to reach his goal is actually getting the space. Like you could have made a very interesting movie without it having to be about space. You know, it is nice and ties in well and all that stuff, but, NASA didn't have to be involved, you know, or
oh yeah,
Gattaca's version of NASA.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think one good example of that is the way that Ethan is studying all this stuff. And, you know, he's reading the celestial textbooks and things like that. And when they go out swimming for that last time and they, you know, it's too foggy and they get lost and he doesn't really know, he looks up at the stars and his knowledge of the stars can show him which direction it is, and he knows which cardinal direction it is back to shore, even if he can't see it. And that's just him having studied so much and doing the things that people who are determined do, not people who are born with a better physical specimen can do. You know, Anton might be the best swimmer, but if they get lost, only one of them is going to know how to get back, and it's because he tried harder because he felt he had to.
Yeah, exactly. Like, to quote him, he never saved anything for the swim back. Like, he knew he needed everything with him at all times, you know, mentally and physically. And I think that's the thing that's really cool about this movie. And I also love the casting of Anton, because Lauren Dean, who I don't think even tries to be an actor anymore, but like in the late 90s was sort of a leading man on the rise. And I mean, if you look at him, he's just so blandly Hollywood-y, you know, like, and he's a decent enough actor and all these things. He was in Enemy of the State around this time. He was the lead in Mumford. And then I think pretty quickly after that, he just decided acting wasn't for him. But like, it's really funny because he's like this leading man that could have been created in a lab. Like if you just look at his face and his hair and everything, he's just white and blandly attractive and is able to deliver his lines in an all right way. And then you've also got Ethan Hawke, who ends up, I think, eventually having one of the more interesting careers in Hollywood. And I just find it really interesting how well they have, they kind of represent their characters even in a totally accidental way like that.
Yeah, there's no way you could know that, but yeah. That works out perfectly.
Yeah, exactly. I'm curious to know who would win in a swim race between the two of them.
I don't know.
I feel like Ethan Hawke doesn't know that much about stars, though, so they might both get lost and drown. So don't, Ethan Hawke, if you're listening, do not participate. I need the next version of the Before series in 8 years or whatever. But yeah, anything else you want to add about Gattaca?
I was gonna ask you what maybe you think about religion or alcoholism, but in this movie at least.
Oh, in this movie. Yeah, I mean I don't know how I feel about religion in this movie, because it does feel like a movie that believes God exists somehow while also totally being about science. Like it never really seems to give a whole answer. And the fact that the term godchild is used, you know?
Yeah. As an insult.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Notably.
That is true. Yeah, I don't have a take on it.
Yeah. Okay.
What about you?
Yeah, no, partially just the fact that is used in a pejorative sense. You know, that sounds like something that you read that word and you assume it's maybe the nicest thing anyone's ever tried to say about anybody is to call them the godchild. But yeah, I mean, I just, and I don't know too much about, you know, the writer director here, but it seems to me that he strikes me as a religious person. Mm-hmm. And you know, by flipping that word around, I think it's his way of saying that science is reaching this point where it's treated with such value and such reverence that we're really getting far away from these things. And, you know, he's got a Bible quote in the in the intro, but he's got another one too, and clearly trying to take the other side of it. But, you know, I'm not certain, and maybe he's kind of using God as the short form for human nature, as, you know, some people are willing to do. Just the idea that getting away from nature is the best thing you can do is the way that it seems society has taken it at this point.
Yeah.
And I think that's obviously, you know, sounds odd for a reason. But we, you know, we have that quote. What is it that not only are we going to tamper with Mother Nature, I think Mother wants us to.
Yeah.
I think he's just pointing out a society that I think is taking science and, you know, medicine and things like that to such a degree that we're kind of getting too far away from where we started, and maybe losing sight of why we started to do it in the first place. And that's where all these questions of free will and determination and doing more than what you were told you could do. And that's that discussion that they're having while Ethan's on the treadmill is all about, that no one outdoes their potential. If someone outdoes their potential, then, you know, we just mischaracterize what their potential is, or, you know, it's a paraphrase, but kind of getting to those, you know, that goes hand in hand with, why don't we leave something to chance, not planning everything out and not having everything squared up to a T, that some of the natural things about human nature can still play out. My understanding that there's a deleted scene where they list all the people who wouldn't be born in a Gattaca society, and, you know, Lou Gehrig and Stephen Hawking and all these great people who achieved such great things and, you know, arguably furthered society. But if we pretended like we knew everything all the time, they wouldn't have even had a chance, and they wouldn't allow us to know more things. And, just that idea of mystery in the universe is, I think, very central to what he wants to say in this movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. And, yeah, it kind of, I don't know, like, I feel like if they didn't use so many, or didn't, you know, add, like you said, that quote up front about, from the Bible and the term Godchild, I feel like it would just sort of be more of an argument for doing things the natural way, not necessarily, and, you know, you can, it can be the natural way without believing in God, you know, like just the general ways of nature. But, like, it just does feel sort of more pro-religion because of those few things that are added into the movie. And I think I agree with you about the director is probably a God-fearing man.
Yeah, but I don't think it comes off as religious. And I don't think that if you are not a religious person, everything that this movie wants to say is thrown out the window.
No, exactly. What I'm trying to say. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I would agree. And as far as alcoholism, I feel like it just sort of uses... it uses alcohol in pretty much the way most movies use alcohol, right? Like, it's just our character that's most associated with alcohol is Eugene, who is depressed. And what's a quick way to show somebody in a movie is depressed? Show them drink too much, you know, because it's like, oh, they don't have anything to live for. They've got to just drink away their sorrows, you know? And I feel like that's sort of how alcohol is presented for the most part, you know? And even though... when they do go out to celebrate, when they must get drunk immediately, like that's a more positive form of drinking, but it's still something that is rooted in sadness. Like, he's still the type of person that wants to chug a glass of wine because he doesn't really view the world as something that he's necessarily a part of anymore, really.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's when, you know, they're celebrating Ethan doing something that Jude could never do. And I think that's why he chugs that whole glass, is his way to, you know, do that classic Hollywood way of, I can't handle what's going on right now, so I'll drink. But he eventually kind of sees what Ethan's doing as a success, and as kind of a team success between what they had done together as a group. And, you know, even though, as I said, tragically it ends in suicide, it's kind of a bit of successful closure for him in a way.
Yeah. Yep, I would agree.
Speaking of successful closures.
Yeah, thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Check out our website for more episodes. All right, thanks.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.